20 years is enough. That's reportedly Joe Biden's position on Afghanistan. Today we hear that forever war may soon be coming to an end. Also today, as migrants from the Middle East and Africa try and reach Europe, Greek authorities appear to have a new strategy, push people back out to sea.
I never imagined when they see people with life jackets, with nothing in the middle of the sea, and they push them back and they leave them for dead.
And in France, a lot of vaccine skeptics. The French are becoming more accepting of a COVID vaccine, but they're also getting picky. Moderna versus Pfizer.
Some people who get Moderna, they feel like they have an handicap because they didn't get Pfizer.
A handicap because they didn't get Pfizer. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us today. President Biden has set a new deadline to pull American troops out of Afghanistan, September 11th of this year. According to reports, that's the date the U.S. will order all its service members to leave Afghanistan. It's an important development in the push to end this nearly two-decade-long war. The World's Shirin Jafari has been our eyes on the Afghanistan story and joins me now. What do we know, Shirin, about this new date and why it was announced today?
So, like you said, Marco, there are reports today that President Biden is going to make an announcement tomorrow about the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. Right now, senior administration officials are saying the troops will be out of the country by September 11th. And here's something that's important, Marco. Officials are saying that the U.S. withdrawal is not conditions-based, meaning that no matter what, come September 11th, the troops will leave.
How is this new date different from what U.S. officials have been saying before?
So previously, the deadline was set for May 1st, in just about 2 weeks from now. That date was set as part of a deal between the Trump administration and the Taliban. But as we are getting closer and closer to this date, it just became clear that the withdrawal is just very unlikely to take place. There are several reasons for that, Marco, because there are no peace agreements between the Taliban and the Afghan government. And pulling troops out of a country takes a lot of work. So it just became clear that this is not going to happen by May 1st. So as things stand at this moment, the U.S. is planning to extend this deadline by about 4 months.
Do we know how the Taliban is responding to this?
I did call their spokesperson just before I got on this call with you, Marco. He didn't respond. But yeah, that's a critical part of the equation because the Taliban can say the U.S. did not live up to its part of the deal. And it can either walk away, it can start fighting, it can increase its violence. So it's really important that we find out how they are seeing this development.
Also, Shirin, the meaning of this deadline of 9/11, the 20th anniversary of that fateful day, why make that the deadline?
Of course, it's hard to say why exactly the Biden administration chose this date. But some obvious answers are, you know, this is the anniversary of 9/11. You know, it's symbolic. It's also a reminder to the American people that the U.S. has been at war in Afghanistan for 2 decades. And President Biden strongly believes that it's time to end this war. He has said repeatedly in the past that he wants to bring troops home. It's also partly because President Biden has a lot on his plate, both domestically and internationally. You know, you have the pandemic, there's the economy, tensions with China and Russia, and the Iran nuclear deal. And it seems like President Biden wants to focus his attention on those issues instead of the war in Afghanistan.
As for Afghans in Afghanistan, how are they going to see this news?
Of course, a lot of people are anxious about what this could mean for their future in terms of security. Who is going to govern Afghanistan if there is no peace agreement? Will the country descend into civil war? These are questions on the minds of many Afghans these days.
Yeah, very interesting and big news. The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome, Marco.
In pandemic news today, U.S. federal health officials hit pause on Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. A rare blood clotting disorder appeared in 6 women who got the shot. Officials now want to study that complication. More on that in a few minutes. First, though, to France, where vaccine hesitancy has long been historically high. More people, though, have been warming to the idea of getting a COVID vaccine. Around 70% of the French now say they'll get one. But as reporter Rebecca Rossman in Paris recently found out, some are shopping around for their preferred version of the shot, and there's concern that could lead to wasted vaccines.
The Stade de France, just north of Paris, is one of 40 stadiums across the country being converted into mass vaccination centers. The goal is to vaccinate up to 10,000 people a week here, a crucial number to help France reach its goal of vaccinating 30 million people by mid-June.
And here's the first group of 1 o'clocks. They're going into their appointments now.
The two vaccines being offered here are Moderna and Pfizer. Both use the same mRNA technology. Both have an efficacy rate of around 94%. But one is being favored over the other.
Je ne sais pas pourquoi les gens veulent tous du Pfizer.
Pfizer, says Brigitte Abel, who manages the call center here. Operators here call up people eligible for the vaccine and ask if they'd like an appointment. In France, people have the right to choose which vaccine they want based on what's available.
Donc, on essaie d'expliquer aux gens qu'il faut, voilà, on essaie de les rassurer, de leur dire qu'il n'est aucun.
Abel says once the phone operators here explain that Moderna and Pfizer use the same technology, most have no problem accepting either one. But she admits there are still a lot of misunderstandings about COVID-19 vaccines in France, and this sort of vaccine shopping could lead to vaccine waste. Some believe the bias comes from the fact that, in French, Moderna kind of rhymes with AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca being the Oxford-developed vaccine that has been linked to rare cases of blood clotting, affecting less than 0.001% of the population, mostly in women under 55 years old. As an extra precaution, AstraZeneca is now only being recommended in France to people aged 55 and over.
Et donc globalement, l'analyse bénéfice-risque montre le fait que le vaccin.
In a video published last week, France's vaccine czar, Alain Fischer, still urged those over 55 to take the AstraZeneca vaccine, stating the benefits far outweigh the risks. Unused stocks of AstraZeneca, however, are piling up, and a recent poll showed more than 70% of the French population doesn't want to take AstraZeneca. Latifa Ahmad is one of them. The 56-year-old pharmacy technician tells me she declined an offer to get the AstraZeneca vaccine several months ago. Today, she's at the Stade de France getting the Moderna shot, and she's excited.
Moi, je voyais là aujourd'hui, je sais que c'est le Moderna, je suis tout à fait confiante.
I'm totally confident in Moderna, she says.
36-3.
D'accord.
Vous n'avez pas de problème particulier de santé,
non.
De médicaux?
A nurse asks her a couple of standard questions, and a fireman whisks her into a tiny booth to give her the shot.
Tout va bien?
Oui, très bien, j'ai rien senti.
Eh ben, je vais
She didn't feel anything. It's over.
At the other end of the room, 67-year-old Jocelyn Camara has just had the Pfizer vaccine.
They would have given me AstraZeneca. I would have taken AstraZeneca. And it's terrible because some people who get Moderna, they feel like they have a handicap because they didn't get Pfizer.
The most important thing, she says, is that we're protected from COVID-19. And all the vaccines available have been proven to prevent hospitalizations and 100% of COVID-19-related deaths. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
As we said earlier, U.S. health officials are pausing the rollout of the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. They recommend states stop using it for the moment. Following the announcement, Johnson & Johnson also announced it was delaying the rollout of the vaccine in Europe amid the probe. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. What exactly happened here, Alana?
So, Marco, officials say it was out of an abundance of caution. Of the nearly 7 million doses of the J&J vaccine that have been administered in the U.S., U.S. officials are investigating 6 serious cases of blood clotting. Dr. Anne Schuchat is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and she said today that it's important to understand that the U.S. has actually given out more than 100 million doses of vaccines, mostly Pfizer and Moderna, and they've not identified anything similar.
So we're taking this pause and precautions around the J&J product in the context of a large, robust, and highly safe and effective vaccination effort.
And a U.S. independent vaccine advisory committee meets tomorrow to review the developments. European health authorities had already flagged some of these cases and are also monitoring them.
So, Ilana, I know this is extremely rare, these blood clots, but in Europe, many countries have put a hold on AstraZeneca's vaccine over very rare blood clots, just like has been done with the Johnson & Johnson, which uses a similar technology. Do we know what the cause of this might be?
Scientists aren't totally sure, and Johnson & Johnson has even said there's no, you know, proven cause. But the rare clots being investigated in both the J&J and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines, they are similar. And they involve people with low levels of platelets, which is the part of the cell that helps blood clot. And Dr. Janet Woodcock, acting commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, she said today that their main theory is the vaccine triggers a rare immune response that involves this.
The person being vaccinated makes an immune response, potentially, that actually involves their own platelets or other parts of the coagulation system and can cause this problem.
And Marco, Europe and the UK have received reports of about 200 people with possible blood clots who've gotten the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. That's out of more than 30 million people who've gotten the shot. And so in a lot of ways, many stress that this reaction of the monitoring agencies showcases what they're there to do for this very reason, to ensure that vaccines are safe and that any issues are taken seriously.
So both the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson one, they're a single shot. They're easy to store, they're easy to transport, which is important, obviously, for many parts of the world. So what exactly does this news mean for the global rollout?
This is a really big deal. I talked with Dr. Krishna Udaikmar about this. He's a professor in global health at Duke University. And he tells me it's concerning for global access to vaccines and equity.
Those two vaccines have been really what the world has been betting on. Right now, we've projected that there would be, by the end of this year, 3 billion doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine available and 1 billion doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
And Marco, much of that has been geared towards low and middle income countries. COVAX, that's the initiative that is ensuring equitable distribution around the world. That initiative has purchased AstraZeneca and J&J vaccines. The Africa Union reached a deal recently to directly purchase up to about 500 million doses of the J&J vaccine. And then South Africa specifically has really turned to J&J. It's home to a plant that's getting ready to make the vaccine. And the country's also been running its own trial of the vaccine because of worries that the AstraZeneca vaccine isn't as effective against the B1351 variant that's now dominant there.
Right. A lot of countries depending on those two vaccines. So how is that trial going in South Africa? Have they identified similar problems?
So about a quarter of all health workers in South Africa, nearly 300,000 people, have gotten the J&J shot through the trial there. I reached out to lead researchers. They weren't ready to comment yet on this U.S. development. They're meeting today to discuss it. But a Maine scientist did tell one of South Africa's largest newspapers today that they had not detected any of the rare blood clots in their trial. And again, the WHO does recommend the AstraZeneca shot, saying that the benefits far outweigh the risks of COVID-19, for example, and the clotting associated with that. Going back to Krishna Udaikmar with Duke, he says the big concern also is about in what way these U.S. actions might influence hesitancy in other parts of the world. What the U.S. does this week and its guidance moving forward really has downstream implications.
The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Just a few days ago, on a beach on the Greek island of Lesbos. A rubber boat carrying 70 migrants, most of them children, touches land. For years now, this has been a regular occurrence on the Greek Aegean Islands, a gateway into Europe for migrants fleeing war and violence in the Middle East, Africa, elsewhere. The number of people arriving is way down from its peak 6 years ago, but many still make the journey to seek asylum, often by boat from neighboring Turkey. Now there is mounting evidence that Greek authorities are preventing migrants from doing that. They're accused of intercepting asylum seekers at sea and pushing them back to Turkey. From Greece, The World's Lydia Manalidou has our story.
This is the spot where Iraqi photographer Yusuf Oshweili arrived on Lesbos about 3 years ago.
I saw this view. Exactly where we are sitting.
We sit on a bench by the island's main port in Mytilene.
You came right into this port.
Yeah. I don't know. It was like just a beautiful, beautiful moment.
El-Shweli, who's now a recognized refugee, fled Baghdad. He took a dinghy from Turkey with dozens of other migrants. Mid-journey, the boat broke.
We were in the middle of the sea. The middle of the sea.
Children were screaming, and El-Shweli was certain he would die. But the Greek Coast Guard spotted them, scooped them up, and brought them here. This is what authorities are supposed to do. But these days, migrants say more and more the Greek Coast Guard is pushing them back to Turkey.
Please help me!
This is a video from about 10 days ago. 27 people are in a rubber boat. 11 of them are children. They're stopped by the Greek Coast Guard.
The Greek police catch us.
Guard members start towing the dinghy back towards Turkey.
We are moving to Fatah, Turkey.
According to migrants, Greek authorities then bring people up to their vessel, drive closer to Turkey, force them onto a life raft, and leave them at sea. In a video from the life raft, a woman pleads for help as the inflatable raft bounces in the waves and her baby clings onto her for support. These videos were sent to Aegean Boat Report, an NGO that tracks pushbacks.
What the Greek government is doing and what we have documented them doing through testimonies, through evidence sent to us by survivors, is that people are being abandoned in the middle of the sea.
Lorraine Leet is with Legal Center Lesvos, another organization that's documenting pushbacks and giving legal support to survivors. She says people are not just being intercepted at sea. There are also reports of asylum seekers who are reaching the Greek islands,
who are then being arrested, detained in unofficial detention sites,
and are then forced onto boats and sent back to Turkey. Leet says this practice is not new.
But there has been an increase in systemic practice of pushing people back. And what it seems to be is that the Greek administration, the EU, has not been able to implement the EU-Turkey deal in the past year as it was intended.
Under this deal, struck in 2016, Turkey agreed to close its borders and stop asylum seekers from coming into Europe in exchange for EU funds. It also agreed to take back people whose asylum applications were rejected in Greece. But that's not happening.
And as a result, we see that unofficially, Greece has been stopping people from coming, has been pushing people back to Turkey because it cannot officially deport people.
Greek authorities deny this is happening, but the evidence is mounting, and major humanitarian organizations are stepping in. That includes the UN's Refugee Agency. Mireille Girard heads the UNHCR's efforts in Greece. She sat down with me for an interview at their offices in Athens.
The fact is that the frequency of reports is increasing.
She says since the beginning of last year, UNHCR has been looking into 300 cases of pushbacks in Greece alone. She walks me through one case from mid-February that they've been able to verify.
What we know is that several families of Afghan nationals arrived on Lesvos Island.
There were 13 people, including four children. They presented themselves to the authorities and were put in a reception area with new arrivals. But overnight, they were forced into a van and driven to a port.
Once they reached a port, they were taken out at sea on a speedboat and from there put on a life raft without life jackets and left adrift until they were rescued by Coast Guard later on the Turkish side of the waters.
These are details UNHCR says it's been able to verify by speaking with witnesses and survivors and reviewing other evidence. Girard says these reports deserve attention.
Asylum is a human rights. It's an imperative norm of human rights. When there are indication that there may have been a pushback, this incident need to be looked at very formally and very seriously. Because this is illegal.
Critics say that Greece and a number of EU member states have been way too complacent. They say Greece isn't doing enough to investigate these pushbacks and that EU member states are turning a blind eye to the problem.
And you see this atmosphere, this climate of impunity spreading.
Tineke Strik is a Dutch member of the European Parliament. She's part of a committee that's currently investigating what role EU border agents may be playing in pushbacks. She says the messaging from top EU officials isn't helping. She brings up something the European Commission president said last year when she visited Greece.
She said, "You are our shield."
Which Strik took to mean,
"You're doing a good job because you keep the migrants out." You know, and as long as this is the message, member states feel free to go on with these violations.
Back at the port, Yusuf El-Shweli says it was hard for him to believe that human rights violations like this could happen in Europe.
I never imagined when they see people with life jackets, with nothing in them pockets, in the middle of the sea, and they push them back and they leave them for dead. I never imagined that will happen here.
He says there's no doubt in his mind this is happening. He's heard too many stories from people on this island and seen too much evidence. Today, he's spending a lot of his time documenting alleged pushbacks in the hope it'll bring attention to the issue and justice to survivors. For The World, I'm Lydia Menlidou in Athens, Greece.
We reached out to the Greek Coast Guard. In a statement today, they told us that claims by NGOs are based on unsubstantiated reports and unreliable sources, and that the Greek Coast Guard follows all national and international laws. For the past few weeks, you've been hearing Lydia Manolidou's reporting on the situation with refugees in the Greek islands. If you want to ask Lydia some questions directly, she'll be hosting an Instagram Live tomorrow, Wednesday at 12 Eastern. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org and join us tomorrow on Instagram. We are at PRI The World. Coming up in the second half of the show, Moscow continues its military buildup along Ukraine's border. President Biden has told President Putin to stand down. Also, Netflix money is sloshing around India. Filmmakers are loving that, but also worried about government restrictions. You're listening to The World. Netflix and Amazon Prime are invested big time in India.
They say marriages are made in heaven, but on the ground, the reality is slightly different.
So true, and this burst of streaming creativity in India may be curtailed by government regulations.
I can't think of any political party which has not banned something in India.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Biden spoke today with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They discussed a range of issues, including arms control and election interference. According to the White House, Biden also emphasized Washington's unwavering commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Specifically, Biden raised concerns about Russia's military buildup along Ukraine's borders and called on Moscow to de-escalate. What Biden expressed was also repeated today by NATO leaders meeting in Brussels. Mykhailo Samas is following all of this. He's the director and a military analyst for the new Geopolitics Research Network in Kyiv. Mykhailo, what is going on in Crimea and on Ukraine's borders? Can you just describe this military buildup?
Well, what happened now, it's Russia started to make military exercises very close to Ukrainian border, and they shipped some additional military units from a deep Russian territory to Ukrainian border. When we're talking about the military readiness of Russia to attack Ukraine, I would say yes, Russia is ready to attack in a full-scale operation. I think that the main goal of Putin's military demonstration these last days was exactly the conversation with President Biden. Now, I think it's good for Putin. Biden called to Russian president. Biden proposed Putin to meet in some third country to discuss all of these issues. I think for this time, it's a finish of escalation. But of course, Putin won't stop the military demonstration now because he will show that he won't be ready to de-escalate because Biden asked him.
So unpack that for us, Mykhailo, because it sounds like what you're saying is that Putin has pushed all these troops onto Ukraine's borders and into Crimea to get Joe Biden's attention, and now he's got it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. From the military point of view, Russia is ready every minute, any time to attack Ukraine because it's enough. Russia has enough forces on its territory around Ukraine. It's like 100,000 troops. It's like 1,000 tanks, 1,000 aircraft. So now it was a demonstration that they have a lot of forces to attack Ukraine.
Mykhailo, you're a veteran of Ukraine's armed forces. How is Ukraine's military responding to this buildup? Can they stand up to Russia militarily?
Ukrainian military is doing pretty good in preparations. The problem for Ukrainian military is that we don't have a proper missile defense now because for last years, Russia built a lot of missile system around Ukraine. And I think we should go a little bit faster in NATO standard because it's asymmetric compared to Russian armed forces. Of course, Russian armed forces is larger and it's impossible to compare.
I know Ukraine's President Zelensky has said recently he would like Ukraine to be fast-tracked into NATO and that Ukraine needs NATO to guarantee its security. Do you agree with him?
Absolutely. I think that this is the best way to secure Ukraine and to defend Ukraine, because if we're talking about missile defense, if we're talking about network center of warfare, individually it's possible to make, but it's very expensive, and alone for Ukraine it's absolutely difficult to do it. Together inside of the NATO, for Ukraine it will be much more easier to get such systems and actually to be under the umbrella of NATO security systems.
So what's the path forward here? Is there anything Ukraine can do to keep conflict from happening, or is it all in Russia's hands? Do they hold all the cards?
For Ukraine, it's only one way. It's to build up the own armed forces and, of course, try to get support from partners. First of all, United States, UK, Canada, Baltic states, Romania, countries like this, and try to be closer to the NATO. But I'm not sure that we will get some stronger support on the field. And Ukrainian armed forces should be ready to fight alone against Russians. Nobody will fight for our country, only Ukrainian armed forces and Ukrainian people, it's obviously. So I think we're all doing our best in protect our country.
Mikhail Osamas is the director. He's also a military analyst for the New Geopolitics Research Network in Kyiv. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In India, Amazon and Netflix both have heavy investments. Thanks to inexpensive internet on smartphones across India, video streaming is booming. Just as here, that's created an exciting new era of film and TV. Complaints from police, though, and a slew of new government regulations over content have filmmakers concerned that their newfound creativity will soon be curtailed. From Kolkata, Sandeep Roy reports.
In 2018, Netflix released Sacred Games, its first India original, made in Hindi, based on an English novel. It's about a gangster who tells a cop he has just 25 days to save Mumbai. 25 din hai, bacha lena apne sher ko. It was a game changer, Indian filmmaker Hansal Mehta remembers.
The prospect of being able to tell stories that don't necessarily fit into mainstream Indian cinema format.
The streaming platforms offered an escape from the tyranny of opening weekend box office numbers and strict censorship rules. Sacred Games took on religion, sexuality, politics, gender more frankly. It felt more real, more adult. Other series followed suit: sports dramas, spy thrillers, Made in Heaven, a series about big fat Indian weddings with a gay lead.
They say marriages are made in heaven, but on the ground, the reality is slightly different.
It seemed like a match made in heaven between the likes of Amazon and Netflix, anxious to reach the huge Indian market, and storytellers like Mehta.
Suddenly you felt that maybe we can make a Breaking Bad kind of show here.
That brief spring of content might be ending. Online news outlets and streaming platforms are coming under the Indian Ministry of Information and Broadcasting. The government says print and cinema are regulated. Streaming platforms need to be monitored too. Salil Tripathi is the author of Offense, The Hindu Gaze, a book on freedom of expression. He says this is an old debate dating back to the First Amendment to the Indian Constitution in the 1950s.
Unlike the American one, this one actually imposes restrictions on media.
It did so in the name of preserving harmony in a very diverse country. For example, in 1988, it banned the import of Salman Rushdie's satanic verses because Muslim groups protested. Since then, Tripathi says all kinds of books and films have faced bans from all quarters.
I can't think of any political party which has not banned something in India.
Not just books and films, also advertising. Recently, an ad for a jewelry company showing a Hindu-Muslim couple infuriated some people so much the company pulled it. Best-selling writer and advertising professional Anuja Chauhan says the apology sent out the wrong message.
If you're not going to keep your ad out there, they don't make your ad. Yeah. It's terrible because it does more of an injustice to the cause. It's the same thing now. Amazon is doing grumbling all over the place or making tandoor.
Tandav is a political thriller from Amazon Prime. Some politicians said it had hurt Hindu sentiments with comments about the god Shiva and caste. It had 10 complaints filed against it in half a dozen states. A high court judge opined filmmakers seem to take license with Hindu gods in a way they do not with Jesus or the prophet Muhammad. It is true, in India, an insensitive Facebook post can trigger deadly riots. The government says the new streaming rules will actually help by creating clear standards. Ravi Shankar Prasad is the Minister for Law and Electronics and Information Technology. He told a press conference that platforms need a mechanism to respond to viewer grievances.
Who shall register the grievance within 24 hours and disposal in 15 days?
If there are complaints about exploiting women through sex and nudity, they will have 24 hours to act.
This particular provision is designed to respect the dignity of the women of India.
Meanwhile, a children's rights body wants the series Bombay Begums taken off for its portrayal of minors and sex and drugs. A complaint was filed against the social saga A Suitable Boy, asking if a kissing scene was filmed inside a temple. Author Salil Tripathi says it's not that people don't have the right to be offended.
The simplest solution, right? If you don't like something, don't watch it, don't read it, campaign against it, write a better book.
Instead, there can be a court case that drags on for years. A film set can be vandalized. A comedian can find himself in lockup for a joke he didn't even make. That, Tripathi says, can have a chilling effect for future projects. Hansal Mehta understands this threat too well. 20 years ago, a line in one of his films upset a political party. He says it was blown up out of context, but he was roughed up and his face smeared with black ink.
I know that something within me completely died. As a creative person, I died a slow death.
It took him 11 years to make another film, this time about a human rights lawyer named Shahid, who faces threats for the work he does.
When Shahid's face is blackened outside the court, it is an autobiographical moment. It was me.
But he says writers always find ways to tell stories. He has made offbeat films since then that have dealt with controversial real-life stories. The human rights of terror suspects, a gay professor facing blackmail, a stock market scam. Streaming has given these films a whole new lease of life.
It has opened up a world of possibilities for us as filmmakers, as storytellers. It has given us our audience.
That's why he remains optimistic about the future of streaming in India and is willing to test out its new guidelines. For The World, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
We've all heard about prehistoric cave paintings, but what about prehistoric evidence left by animals? Take southern Brazil. In recent years, thousands of massive tunnels have been discovered there, tunnels that were not created by humans. Scientists believe the burrows could be 12,000 years old, perhaps much older. For paleontologists, it's a big discovery and is opening up a whole new branch of their field of study. From southern Brazil, Michael Fox has that story.
I'm standing near the side of a major interstate highway in southern Brazil, BR-116. It feels like an industrial wasteland. There's car parts stores, broken down building behind me, spray painted front walls, concrete crumbling, grass and weeds sprouting its way up through the concrete. And yet it was here, just down the street, that Heinrich Frank made his first big discovery a decade ago.
Como é que pode, né? E foi exatamente essa situação. Eu passo na rodovia.
Geologist Heinrich Frank says, I was on the highway going 60 miles an hour on a Friday afternoon, and I saw this excavation with a hole. So I went there and saw it was a tunnel. A paleoburrow. That's a burrow made by a prehistoric animal, likely an armadillo or an extinct giant ground sloth. These types of sloths were huge, some the size of a modern-day elephant. So you can imagine the size of their burrows. Almost 2,000 paleoburrows have been found across southern South America, mostly in the Brazilian states of Santa Catarina and Rio Grande do Sul, which border Uruguay and Argentina. Frank and his team at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul have found the majority of them. I had to see one for myself. From the end of the road near a village named Nova Homa, it takes several hours to hike in. The trail winds up a valley, passing back and forth over a river which meanders downstream. We pass up through lush tropical vegetation, and before us is a massive hole in the side of the hill.
Bacana, cara. Meu Deus.
The main gallery of this paleoburrow is huge. The ceiling is maybe two or three stories high, with four tunnels leading off in different directions. This is amazing, I tell my guide. This is one of the largest and most well-known paleoburrows. Most don't have such a complex system. For decades, local residents said these tunnels were dug by the Xokleng indigenous peoples in order to hide out when under attack by colonizing Europeans. But Frank and his team said it was clearly a paleoburrow. You can tell by the claw marks. They're the most defining feature of many paleoburrows found across the region. Scientists say they are the mark of the giant ground sloth. We walk through one of the tunnels. It's just under my height, so I have to bend over slightly. And there they are. Deep, parallel gashes scrape across the ceiling and sides of the cave. It's awe-inspiring. But alongside the claw marks is something else. Initials, names, and words carved into the sandstone walls, left there by human visitors. It's been really degraded since the first time I came here, says my guide, Marcelo Crepaldi, as we walk back down the trail. When I was first here in the 1990s with a local school trip, there were no marks or names. Now, there are even walls collapsing from being messed with. Frank's university group, the Paleoburrows Project, has waged a campaign to raise awareness about the existence of paleoburrows. But it's an uphill battle, particularly amid major budget cuts to education, research, and grants. His team is also fighting time. Remember the first paleoburrow he found on the side of the highway? It was one of more than 15 they located in that same area. There were condominiums of giant armadillos there, says Frank. But today, you go there and there's nothing. Houses have been built on top. There are retaining walls. People are living on top of them. That's the contradiction in paleoburrow research. It's development, new houses, highway expansion that often cuts into the ground and makes it possible to discover these burrows. But once they're open, it's only a matter of time until most are destroyed by the elements, rain or construction. Frank isn't deterred.
A importância das paleotocas é basicamente porque você consegue.
He says, this is so important because you can reconstruct the home of a prehistoric animal. This research doesn't exist in any branch of paleontology. You have the dinosaurs, you have their bones, but you don't know where they lived. Not us. We find their home. Our group is on the new frontier in this area. That's their challenge, he says, developing methods of research in this new field, documenting each location before it's gone. For the world, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
To see photos of these megatunnels built by prehistoric animals in southern Brazil, come over to our website. We are at theworld.org. We're now 101 days away from the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics. Yep, they're still called the 2020 Games. Today, the Olympic torch relay continued its tour through the mostly empty streets of Osaka, Japan. A pretty muted affair. Hardly anyone there to watch because they were encouraged to stay home. The timing for the relay in Osaka was far from ideal. Japan's third largest city recorded nearly 1,100 daily cases of COVID-19, a record for that area. Today, International Olympic Committee Vice President John Coates tried to ease worries about the surge of cases in Japan.
I had no hesitation in saying the games will take place and they'll be the safest games possible.
The torch relay rules could be a preview of what's to come. No cheering, no shouting, no loud talking, and lots of cleaning and sterilizing. John Coates encouraged people today to focus on the good in all of this.
The Olympic movement will be able to show, the organizers, the people of Japan will be able to show that this has been a victory of humankind over the pandemic and enable us to show just what can be achieved working together.
Perhaps, but polls show a different picture. Close to 80% of Japanese people want the Tokyo Games to be canceled or delayed. It's been 10 years since an earthquake and tsunami caused a triple meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in northeast Japan. Today, the Japanese government announced it will begin releasing treated radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean in 2 years. The decision was quickly met with opposition from both residents and countries in the region. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler with more.
Demonstrators gathered in Tokyo yesterday to protest the expected decision, which came during a cabinet meeting today. Since the Fukushima disaster, the plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power, has been pumping massive amounts of water into its reactors to cool the melted down fuel. But the clock has been ticking all the while. The company says its on-site storage tanks, more than 1,000 of them, will be full by the fall of 2022, and the best option is to release the water into the ocean after it's treated. The International Atomic Energy Agency supports the plan.
I welcome this important announcement.
The agency's Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi, said in a video today that the agency will dispatch safety review teams to Fukushima.
The method Japan has chosen is both technically feasible and in line with international practice, even though the large amount of water makes it a unique and complex case.
The government and Tokyo Electric Power say the water will be treated and radioactive materials will be reduced to releasable levels. One thing they say they can't remove, though, is a radionuclide called tritium. Protesters near the Fukushima train station yesterday singled out that specific substance in their protest chants. Tritium is formed when hydrogen atoms in cooling water gain two extra neutrons, explains Andrew Karam. He's a radiation safety scientist in New York.
So it's a radioactive form of hydrogen. And it's formed in nuclear reactors. It's also formed in the atmosphere naturally by cosmic ray interactions.
It can be harmful to human health, but only at very high levels, he says.
It takes a lot of tritium to pose a risk to people. And in fact, the EPA drinking water limit for tritium is orders of magnitude higher than it is for just about any other radionuclide.
Based on data published by Tokyo Electric Power, Karam estimates that releasing all the contaminated water at the plant would raise concentration levels in the ocean only a little.
So you've got a big jug of Kool-Aid, and that's the Pacific Ocean, with that sweetness being the normal tritium that's in the Pacific Ocean. And we're talking about adding 1 or 2 grains more sugar to that jug of Kool-Aid. That's the tritium from Fukushima.
But the perception of the release is a different story. The Japanese fishing industry is slowly returning after the nuclear disaster crippled it. Import bans are still being lifted on Japanese fish and agricultural products. And for years, fisheries groups have been vocally opposed to the release of cooling water into the Pacific, where they make their living. Today, fisherman Haru Ono told state broadcaster NHK that he's fed up. I put up with it for 10 years, he said. All the fishermen will disappear from Fukushima. In the port city of Ishinomaki, fisherman Hitosho Endo told Japanese broadcaster TV Asahi that it's taken 10 years for the reputational damage from Fukushima to fade a little. Just when I thought sales would finally increase, he says, the release of treated water will mean we won't be able to do business again. Environmental groups like Greenpeace have spoken out against the decision too, as have regional neighbors China and South Korea. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Finally today, newly released archived music from the Republic of Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. Djibouti gained independence from France in 1977. The new release shows how music played a pivotal role in Djibouti's path to independence. The songs were released on Ostinato Records, known for their curation of music that is hip and also has historic relevance. Vic Sahoni is the founder of Ostinato.
Our latest release is by a group called Four Mars, which in French is Quatre Mars, which translates at the 4th of March. The band is named after the political party that has ruled the small East African Republic of Djibouti, which is on the Red Sea since independence, the RPP. They were founded on the 4th of March, and this band was effectively the political party's band.
Mm-hmm.
For Mars played an integral role in the nation building process. And not too often do we consider bands or music to be nation builders. But in the case of For Mars, they were integral to Djibouti's nation building. And, you know, some there would even credit them as to why Djibouti today is a beacon of stability in a region that has experienced a little bit of strife. One of the tracks on the album, for example, is called Hello Peace. It's a groovy, reggae-filled, funky jam. But at the same time, the message of the song is about welcoming a peaceful future for a very fragile, divided country. In 2016, we traveled to the Republic of Djibouti. We were given a tour of the national radio, and the national radio director introduced us to the archive and said, you know, this is the work that you do. This is the archive we have. You know, let's talk. And 3 years later, we came back with all the necessary equipment to digitize this archive, or at least portions of it, to curate into compilations. And the band For Mars immediately struck us. Right away, you know, we found that this group told the story of this corner of Africa as a major meeting point, as a major middle ground for the world, in which cultures from the Mediterranean, from East Africa, from the Middle East, from India, from faraway as China, had all mingled for hundreds of years. And For Mars is, I think, the best evidence we have of that history, because their sound really is emblematic of it. And also, it's 40 people performing, and that gives it this incredible depth and layers of music that really captured us. And I think it's a testament to the musicianship that exists in this part of the world.
Vic Sahoni there telling us about the latest release from his label, Ostinato Records. The album is For Mars, Super Somali Sounds from the Gulf of Tajura. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.
From PRX.